This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, has been a diagnosis since 1980. And since then, we've seen a huge increase in ADHD diagnosis rates. It's now diagnosed in 11% of children ages 4 through 17. In a society where parents are stressed, teachers are pressured, and doctors are bombarded by drug companies, it's easy to see why we might think medication is the answer. But my guest will tell you that we're looking at this all wrong. Instead of thinking of ADHD in terms of an affliction we need to fix, we should be looking at the flip side. My guest, Dr. Dale Archer, says ADHD can be as much a gift as a diagnosis. Dr. Archer is a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. He's the psychiatric medical director at Lake Charles Memorial Hospital in Louisiana. He's the author of two books, Better Than Normal, a New York Times bestseller, and this latest one called The ADHD Advantage, What You Thought Was a Diagnosis May Be Your Greatest Strength. He lives in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Dr. Archer, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
I want to start by saying you describe ADHD in very simple terms as a brain with a very low boredom threshold.
I think that's the easiest way to understand it. And I can hear some of my esteemed colleagues screaming right now with that statement. But the ADHD brain is easily bored. However, when activated, it can perform at a very, very high level. So if you wanted to explain it in a 30-second elevator conversation when you were riding with someone, that's how I would do it. I think it's accurate.
In 20 years, you say there's been a tripling of ADHD rates, and it's now diagnosed in about 11% of children ages 4 through 17, with about half of them getting medication. Why do you think there's been such a jump?
Well, I think there are multiple reasons. And, of course, the easy scapegoat is the pharmaceutical industry, but I think that oversimplifies it very much. So, as you pointed out, the diagnosis was not officially recognized in the DSM manual until 1980 when the DSM-3 came out. And so we're basically looking at a diagnosis with only 30-some-odd years of history.
We should say the DSM manual you just referred to is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders.
If you look at the reasons why the rate's gone up, we'll start with the classroom. So you have the average number of students to a teacher in an elementary, junior high class running around 35 students. You have one or two rambunctious kids who have some type of ADHD and they're disruptive, and the teacher just throws up their hands and said, I can't keep this going. I've got to have help, and they've got to be on medication. Number two, the parents. Of course, there's a lot of peer pressure on parents, and you know, when your kid is targeted as the one that's disrupting the class and there's a problem and three other kids in the class are taking medication and they're doing well, there's a lot of pressure on the parent to put them on medication. The third thing is the psychiatric profession. When I trained in psychiatry, which was a long time ago, back in the early 80s, we received 50% of our training in psychotherapy and 50% of our training in psychopharmacology and medication, and it was a good mix because you had to understand both to be able to be an effective psychiatrist and to treat someone. Modern psychiatrists get zero training in psychotherapy. It is all pharmacologically based in the majority of residency programs around the United States. So, of course, when someone comes to them, that's really the only option they have. The option is a pill. Next is the fact that the bulk of the prescriptions now aren't even coming from psychiatrists. They're coming from family practitioners. They're coming from pediatricians. They're coming from those that are not as well trained in terms of assessing this. They're coming from those that don't have perhaps therapists in their office to be able to offer alternative strategies to be able to work with the kids. Basically, what they have is medication. Finally, you've got, of course, we mentioned the pharmaceutical industry, and that goes without saying, yeah, they have tremendous profit potential to be able to keep developing more and more of these ADHD drugs, but I'm going to put some blame on our society as a whole. We basically have an immediate gratification culture. It's, we want to get well, we don't want to put a lot of time into it. Therapy takes time, therapy takes effort. pop a pill works. You know somebody else, they've taken it, it works for them. It's easy, it's quick, it's cheap. And so society is another tremendous pressure in terms of why these rates have gone up so much and why we're medicating so much.
So as you basically just said, part of the problem is a scarcity of child psychiatrists who specialize in ADHD. It can be pretty expensive to have a child evaluated. Is there good news on the horizon?
Well, I hope that there's good news on the horizon with others in the field starting to recognize that, wow, we are starting to diagnose too much. But in terms of the evaluation and treatment, I think you've hit the nail on the head. You've got to get an expert in the field, which typically will be either a child psychiatrist or it could be a general psychiatrist who's specialized and treated a large number of ADHD patients. That's where you want your assessment coming from. And all too often, schools have doctors that they refer to. So there'll be a counselor that works with the school, and the kid is identified as having ADHD-like symptoms, and they end up at the doctor that has treated a lot of kids that go to the school. Often they're a pediatrician or perhaps a family practitioner. And, of course, their standard treatment is medication. So the message is, medication, I'm not opposed to medication in all cases, but it needs to be a last resort as opposed to a first resort. And I hear this all the time when I'm doing a talk and they're saying, well, you know, we got diagnosed and we tried the therapy and we tried parental training and we tried self-esteem work with our child and we did it for over 2 years and nothing worked. And so finally we put him on meds and now he's doing great. And what do you say about that? And I would say, you've done it absolutely right. That's exactly the child that should be on medication. You've tried all the other options. Nothing else has worked. And so I applaud you for that. All of that being said, in terms of the problems with the diagnosis and how frequently it's diagnosed, the one thing that's been missing from the conversation throughout, up until now, is the fact that we are talking, when we make this diagnosis, of all the bad things that are going to happen to your child, or perhaps an adult if it's an ADHD adult diagnosis, because of this condition. What we're not talking about, the fact that there are inherent advantages, there are strengths that go along with the ADHD trait. That's what needs to be stressed much, much more.
And we're going to talk about those strengths shortly. You also point out in the book that there are many very successful people who have ADHD in fields ranging from medicine to entertainment. And you interviewed quite a few of them when you were writing this book. Who were some of the people you spoke with?
Well, some of the well-known people that people would know, and I wanted to make it a point to talk to not only successful, well-known people or celebrities, but also just the general public. And so, and I also wanted to include as many jobs as possible and as many personality types as possible in there. But some of the well-known people would be Howie Mandel, who, of course, has been very outspoken about his ADHD, and it really attributes his success as a stand-up comedian to the fact that he does have this trait. Ty Pennington, another one. David Neeleman, of course, has gone on record, and he did in my interview once again, saying that if there was a magic pill that he could take to get rid of his ADHD, he wouldn't do it. He credits that for his creativity and being able to really bring an entire new way of looking at the airline industry. Of course, successful with JetBlue in the U.S. Now he's down in Brazil with Azul Airlines, essentially a copycat of JetBlue, and he's doing it all over again, and it's already grown, I think, to the third largest airline in Brazil. So you have people like that, but then you also have small-town Dr. Mike Watson, for example, who I talk about. You have another gentleman, Mitch, who didn't want us to use his last name, who was a truck driver, which sounds like, wow, how could a truck driver possibly be compatible with ADHD? You'd be bored to death. But he ended up doing these huge, giant, oversized rigs, which take a month to plan, and then you drive the route. And so he was able to hyper-focus in order to get through that and loved it. And then he'd have a month downtime, and then he would do it again. You have trial lawyer Perry Sanders, who's worked with the Michael Jackson family, and says that basically when he is in the middle of a trial, that he goes on hyper-focus autopilot, and the creative ideas he comes up with are bouncing around like bingo balls in a bingo game. So you just have so many different people with so many different strategies, and but each and every one, fascinatingly enough, have come to terms with their ADHD and would say they wouldn't change a thing. And they're the lucky ones who are able to realize the strengths on their own. However, there are many, many people who have not been able to do that, who think it's all bad, who think that they have to try to become normal and have their brain work like everyone else. And those are the ones who really struggle with the classroom and with life itself.
You actually have ADHD yourself, and so does your son. You say you didn't realize you had it until you were well into your career. Did you recognize it in your son early on?
You know, they say doctors make the worst patients. And, of course, doctors, when they go to self-diagnose themselves, are often the worst of all. Interestingly, no, I knew my son had it at a very early age. And I was treating ADHD in my clinic during that time. I knew that I didn't want to treat my son, but I recognized the symptoms in him. And we discussed it with a colleague, and he was assessed. And we actually talked about medication quite in depth and opted not to do it. But even though I had diagnosed and treated hundreds of patients, even though my son had it, I never made the connection that I did, actually, until I wrote my last book, and it had an ADHD chapter in there, and I was researching the chapter, and as I was pulling all the data and the stats and everything on it, it just hit me over the head. And then I would talk to my parents and kind of flash back to my younger years when I was in school. And, of course, you know, the tumultuous childhood, the difficulty focusing in class and paying attention. And my strategy is that since I was relatively intelligent, I was able to sit in the back of the class and go to sleep on my desk. And that's what kept me out of trouble. So, yeah, I didn't realize it until I was well into my late 40s, early 50s. But once I did, of course, after writing that book, and with the bulk of the interest in the book being focused on the ADHD chapter, I knew immediately that was going to be my next book.
We are talking about the book, The ADHD Advantage, by Dr. Dale Archer. He's a psychiatrist in Louisiana, and this is his second book. We're going to talk next about the strengths of an ADHDer when we come back after this break. This is The Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. This is The Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. And we're talking today about ADHD and what that diagnosis can mean if we flip it around and instead of looking at it as a deficit and disorder, we focus on the strengths that my guest says are rarely discussed. I'm talking with Dr. Dale Archer. He's the author of The ADHD Advantage, What You Thought Was a Diagnosis May Be Your Greatest Strength. He's the psychiatric medical director at Lake Charles Memorial Hospital in Louisiana. Before we get into what those strengths are, let's talk for a second about the symptoms, because they sound an awful lot like things that many of us can relate to.
Well, so in a nutshell, if you wanted to think about it, the diagnostic terminology really says it all. So it's attention deficit, difficulty paying attention, hyperactivity disorder. You have hyperactivity. Now, the hyperactivity, very interestingly, typically is gone by the time you reach mid to late teens and get on into your 20s. So really, as an adult, when we're looking at it, it's more of the attention deficit. So with kids, the hyperactivity is often the key symptom that triggers treatment. Because the fact that they don't pay attention, if they're not disrupting the class and if they're not hyperactive, then they're probably going to be left alone and left to their own devices, which may or may not be good. But the hyperactivity is what triggers the treatment. And interestingly, the hyperactivity is seen much more commonly in boys as opposed to girls, which is why boys tend to be medicated much more often than girls are. In terms of adult ADHD, it becomes very different and also a little more complex in terms of if you're making a diagnosis, because all of the symptoms that go along with attention deficit can range from procrastination to inability to finish a task that you're involved in to the boredom, of course, factor, the low boredom threshold. So all of those things can go into the adult ADHD, and you really have to go through them in depth. But the key always is it's very important to determine with the individual, does it disrupt the way you're choosing to live your life? Because you can have these symptoms, you know, be a 10 out of a 10, in terms of the symptoms. And I talk about the continuum theory of ADHD frequently in the book, because I think that's another problem we have, is that we diagnose everyone as ADHD and they're all the same. I propose it should be a continuum going from 1 to 10. Those with a 9, 10, or a 10-plus really have a more severe form of the disorder, probably needs treatment, may even need medication. But certainly most people do not fall in that severe category. So I think that if it's not disrupting how the individual leads their life, then you really have to question whether any treatment at all is needed, because they're doing well, they're coping with it, yeah, they're having the symptoms, but so what? If it is affecting how they live their life, then at that point the conversation would switch to, let's talk about the strengths of this condition before we start talking about treatment.
And so, yes, let's get into some of those strengths.
Yes, let's do. That's the fun part, yes. And I really do enjoy talking about that because, as I said, not many people are doing it and it needs to be done. So I'll list them, just a handful of them, and then we can go back and discuss them one at a time. But we've already touched on the ability to, so easily bored, but ability to hyper-focus when doing something you love. Very, very bored with routine, but does well in times of chaos and in chaotic situations. An ability and a love of multitasking. Resilience, which seems counterintuitive when we're talking about this set of symptoms, but there's actually a scientific study that proves that. So more resilient, creative and nonlinear thinking. And all throughout the book, that's the one thing that comes up over and over and over about, you know, a lot of these folks, they recognize their brains don't work the same as everyone else's, but the creativity and the aha moments that come along are very, very special and a very much a part of the ADHD brain. That's a handful of them right off the bat.
So what do you do about the easily bored? You offer a lot of great strategies in here, by the way.
Yes. Well, okay. So easily bored, number one, and in fact, number one for all of these strengths and weaknesses, is being aware that your brain functions different from other people's brains. It doesn't work the same. So therefore, strategies that work for other people, sitting in a classroom for 8 hours a day, that's not going to be one of your strengths. That's going to be very hard for you. I don't think anyone finds it exciting, but the average brain has no trouble coping with it. So that when you're easily bored, the thing is to recognize why you're easily bored. Well, it's because you have low dopamine tones. So you want to do things to self-excite. And there are a whole host of strategies. And some of the cutting-edge schools, that Eagle Hill School comes to mind in Boston. What they do is they use exercise as a key component of their educational system, to the point where there's chin-up bar in the hall where a child can go out and do a couple of chin-ups and come back. They have time in between classes when they can walk around the building. They emphasize PE and recesses with major activities that are going on there. And, of course, this is all coming when the nation as a whole is cutting PE classes, cutting recesses, cutting down on lunch, to where as many kids go to school and never even get outside throughout the course of a day. And exercise for the ADHD brain is energy. What it does is it kicks up the dopamine and allows the brain to function at a normal dopamine tone. So those are some quick, easy strategies. Another one would be in terms of study. So what the Eagle Hill Schools does and what many other schools do is they don't teach hour classes. They do 15-minute classes, and then they keep repeating because the brain starts getting bored after 15 minutes, and then they change to another subject. So it activates again because it's something new and exciting, and then after 15 minutes, and they'll repeat that throughout the course of the day. So you may have 5 sessions of history throughout the course of your day, but each one is 15 minutes in length. The same strategy works well for the ADHD brain when doing homework. And that's another take-home for parents, is that don't do all your history until it's complete. Do 15 minutes of history, then your math, then your reading, and then repeat. And also take breaks in between, get some exercise, do a quick walk around the block, do some calisthenics, something to pump up the brain, pump up the dopamine tone of the brain, and allow you to focus better. And, of course, the best of all is when we are able to hyper-focus, and that comes when we're really fascinated with a topic. And unfortunately, that is something that we start seeing around college. And the reason is that when the child gets to college, They're able to pick the subjects they like. They're able to find what really fascinates them. They're able to study in their own manner, in their own way. Classes are an hour, hour and 15 minutes, and then they walk and go to another class. It's ideally designed to help the ADHDer. So by the time they get to college, most of these kids are doing pretty well. You know, for the average person, when they're assigned a task, you're assigned a task, and you really don't like the task, but you know you got to do it because you got to get a good grade on in this class, and so you got to do the project. Well, you can make yourself sit down and get through it. But for the ADHDer, so we've already got low dopamine tone, so they were given the task. We're bored. It's like getting the brain to kick into gear and engage becomes extremely difficult. And so you do need these strategies to get through the routine things that you don't care for that much. When you find something you love, it's not going to be a problem at all. You'll hyper-focus, and you can study all night, and it'll be a thrill because you just love the topic, and you're activated, and it's fun and exciting. We used to say in the old days, before we knew any better, that ADHDers outgrew it as they got older. Now we understand that they end up in an environment that's more suited to their skills. And those that do make it to college, of course, have come up with numerous strategies along the way in order to help their brain work at its optimal peak.
And how about their love of multitasking?
You know, that's interesting because there was always a thought out there among myself and a lot of others who were kind of spearheading this ADHD advantage movement that multitasking was tailor-made for the ADHD brain, and we would compare those to normal brains, and they're going to do vastly better. Well, so there was a study that was done not too long ago, and the results were a little disappointing for all of us because they found that the quote-unquote normal brains versus the ADHD brains performed about the same on the multitasking event. But what came out after, the difference was they were able to perform the same, but the ADHDers loved doing the multitasking. It was fun to them. Whereas for the non-ADHDers, it was a chore, and they could do it, and they could do it as well as the ADHDer, but it wasn't fun, and it wasn't something that they enjoyed doing, even though they were able to do it.
And it kind of makes sense, because one of the issues that ADHDers often have is that you need to redirect them. Right.
It makes total sense. We weren't expecting the results, to be honest, but then when you think about it, yeah, it makes total sense because, yeah, with the multitasking, you're constantly shifting from one task to another. Well, the brain never gets bored, so, man, that's great. That feels good, and you're able to keep that going. Whereas for someone else, yeah, they can do it, but for them, it becomes a stressful event because they're having to constantly shift, whereas they would do better actually, if, and at least it would be less stressful, not to say they would necessarily perform better, if they could focus on one task, get that done, and then move on to another.
Let's look at resilience. This was a little surprising.
This was surprising. This was a great study. This came out probably about 3 or 4 years ago from down in North Carolina. And what they did was they took college students and they took 35 of them. I think 18 had ADHD, 17 did not. They made sure the ADHDers were not taking medications, and then they put them both through a series of psychological testing in order to test their resilience, how they would handle difficult situations, and so on and so forth. Well, overwhelmingly, the ADHDers came out as more resilient than the non-ADHDers. And at first glance, you would think, well, how can that be? The ADHDers are dealing with a brain that is easily bored, and it's hard to keep it focused, and so they've got like a built-in disadvantage because they have to deal with their own brain condition in addition to the stress that's on top of it. Well, once again, a little bit of thought, and it becomes very, very clear. So first of all, these are ADHDers that made it to college. So we do have to accept the fact that this is going to be a successful group of the ADHDers because they got there. Second of all, the ones who got there had to be able to perform at the level through grade school and junior high and high school, had to be able to come up with their own set of techniques and strategies to being able to deal with the fact that I've got a brain that doesn't work like everybody else's, and I'm forced into an environment that's for the masses and not for me, so I need strategies to be able to get through this. So it's almost like they're building the resilience as they go, because they have to. So by the time they get to college, which for many kids can be stressful, they're leaving the high school environment, they're going to college, it's new, it's different, they're a little bit afraid, and they're having to readjust. Well, and for the ADHDer, it's like, wow, it's like the handcuffs have come off. All of a sudden, I can do it my way. I can take the classes I want. I can study the way I want. I can do everything the way I want. But I still have all these strategies that I've learned through 15 years of going through a standard school system. Then it makes total sense that, yeah, they've developed incredible strategies to be able to handle a whole host of things. And, of course, strategies is one of the keys to resilience.
And the ADHDer is pretty creative.
They are creative. You know, now this is one which there's no hard scientific data out there, because when you think about it, how do you measure creativity? Very difficult, to say the least. But the one thing that I note from treating patients and that I noted from all of the interviews in the book over and over and over again is the intuition, the creative thought that pops into their brain. Perry Sanders, Michael Jackson's family's attorney, coined the term bingo brain, because he said that, you know, it's like bingo balls bouncing around in the big glass ball, and every now and then one ball will hit right in the right spot, and he likens that to one synapse in his brain fires, and it's this idea that, wow, where did that come from? David Neeleman talks about the same thing. It's they don't get to where they develop the new techniques that they're using, whether it's in the courtroom or the ideas in the courtroom or whether it's in developing a new company, it's a flash of insight that comes almost out of the blue. And so I hear that over and over and over again. And I think that, once again, if we want to think about it and how it makes sense, you got a brain that's sitting around that's, you know, in a low dopamine tone and feeling bored. Well, then you start thinking about ideas, and the more ideas you think about, the more activated your brain gets. And so pretty soon, just the ideas bouncing around in your brain becomes activating in and of itself. And every now and then, one of those ideas becomes a genius idea. And if you're able to capture that, then it can lead to great things.
The ADHDer is also a nonlinear thinker.
And I think that the nonlinear thinker and the creativity really go hand in hand, and I would argue that they're the same thing. I talk about both, but I think that they're very similar, because so oftentimes when you have a problem that's set out before you and you say, okay, well, we got to like make a list of logical steps and how we're going to approach this problem, which would be the logical way to do it. Well, for me and for many of these others, that's not the way they do it. What they do is they just think. They'll start and they'll think about it, and they'll come up again with ideas that seem all over the place. And at some point in this collection of random ideas becomes a logical pattern. So when I say nonlinear, essentially they're not going from step A to step B to step C to step D to step E when they're solving a problem. They may go in a very circuitous fashion, but they end up getting to the result, but it's not in a stepwise pattern that we would think of as a linear pattern, but rather it's in a roundabout way to end up with the solution.
And could that explain why some of them do not catch on to things in school very quickly and then suddenly grasp it and go beyond everybody else?
I think that's a great example, and I do hear that a lot, where they'll be involved with a subject and they'll study it and they'll study it and it just doesn't seem. And we all hear that about, I don't know, one day it just clicked. Mm-hmm. You know, one day it just clicked for me. And I kind of think that there are two possibilities there. Number one is that as you start going through a certain subject, whatever it may be, and as you start getting the basics down, then it could be that they're finding an aspect of it that they're really fascinated with, and all of a sudden that ties it all together. So all of a sudden, if you're studying history and it's just boring, and then you read about an explorer who went off and explored new worlds, and then you get excited about that, well, then that can redefine the whole subject for you. So I think that that's a big part of it. And then, of course, the other aspect, which is quite likely, is that they were able to figure out a strategy along the way, and a lot of times this would be subconscious, a strategy of having this topic figured out.
Can't that be said for most of us who maybe struggle with something at first?
I think that's absolutely true for most of us. But the big difference is, you know, when I talk about hyperfocus, which the ADHD brain is able to do, and again, it's because when we love something, the dopamine is activated and we can hyperfocus on it for hours or days or weeks, but for us to be able to perform well, we need that hyperfocus. Whereas for the non-ADHD brain, the standard brain, they can perform well at something they're really not that interested in. So that's the big difference. Yeah, it's no doubt that we're not saying the learning curve is that much different. We're not saying that some people can struggle with something and then eventually get it. But once again, I think it's more paramount for the ADHD to figure out their strategies and also to keep in mind the ability to hyperfocus and how they can indeed do that if they find something that they truly love.
This is Dr. Dale Archer. He's a psychiatrist in Louisiana and has written this book, The ADHD Advantage: What You Thought Was a Diagnosis May Be Your Greatest Strength. We're going to continue our conversation on the other side of this break. This is The Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith. This is The Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack in today for Faith. And we're talking with psychiatrist Dr. Dale Archer. He's the author of this new book, The ADHD Advantage: What You Thought Was a Diagnosis May Be Your Greatest Strength. I want to go back for a second. You mentioned in the last segment that the hyperactivity part of the diagnosis is seen more in boys than in girls. What are some of the other differences between boys and girls in terms of symptoms?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There needs to be more studies focusing on girls, but as I talk about in the book, many of the girls that are discussed were given other diagnoses when they were in school. So they were diagnosed as depression, perhaps anxiety, and the ADHD diagnosis was not applied to them until much later on when they got into their late teens or 20s. So I think that the key there is the missing hyperactivity. And girls, by nature, it appears, are less prone to acting out than boys. Now, there's no study I'm aware of on this, so this is my personal opinion. But they're less prone to acting out. The acting out is what triggers the attention of the school system, and that triggers the treatment. So the girl who has it may have every bit of the attention symptoms that the boys do, but they sit quietly at their desk. They're not causing a problem in school. So therefore, they're less likely to get noticed.
How do we compare to other countries when it comes to diagnosing ADHD? Is this as prevalent in other parts of the world?
Not even close. So just to give the examples, which I talk about in depth in the book, but I talk about the U.S. where it's right at 11%. I talk about Great Britain, where it's about 2%, and I talk about France, where it's 0.5%. The other interesting statistic is the discrepancy among states. So Nevada has a rate of about 5.8%, whereas Louisiana, my state, is leading the country close to 16%. So the big question is, if this is a true disorder, what in the world is different in these states that is causing this tremendous diagnostic discrepancy, and what in the world is different in between Britain and France and the U.S.? And the clear-cut answer is that this is a subjective diagnosis. We use a checklist of symptoms that we go down and ask questions of the individual, and subjectively, we're going to play a role in that diagnosis. So if it's more accepted in a certain region or a certain area, the greater the likelihood you're going to get that diagnosis. And if it's less accepted, then the less likely. And of course, no one's been able to figure out why Nevada is so low or why Louisiana is so high, but the stats don't lie. And so it just calls into question the entire diagnostic paradigm is what it does.
Well, so here was a shocker. You say, according to a report by the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, which is a nonprofit mental health watchdog, there are over 1,400 0 to 1-year-olds, in other words, babies, on ADHD medications.
Yeah, that's frightening, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's how in the world do you make a diagnosis in someone that's under 1 year of age? I mean, of course, different babies are going to mature at different rates. And, of course, the landmark study in the Archives of General Psychiatry about 15 years ago, which showed that the number one predictor of the ADHD diagnosis in school-age, grade school kids, is the age of the child within the given grade. So, for example, in a first-grade class, you would have 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, and 7-year-olds. Those that have the youngest age, chronologic age, receive the diagnosis much, much more than older, which makes us wonder, wow, is this just immaturity, that these kids are less mature, so it's harder for them to sit still, it's harder to do homework, it's harder to focus, it's harder to concentrate because they're younger.
But we don't know that. We can't figure that out. They're younger.
Here's the problem. So, yeah, they're younger, but you have an overworked teacher who's trying to manage the class. The child is younger, without a doubt. But if he's disruptive in any way, then that's where the attention's going to go. And once the attention is focused on the child, then they're put in almost like you're on the assembly line then. You're going to be seen by the school counselor. They're going to assess you. They're going to move you on to the recommended doctor that the school uses. The school doctor knows that he only gets involved or gets called when there's really a behavioral problem. And they know, of course, it's well known that the meds will calm down the behavior. So there's no doubt about that these stimulant medications will calm these kids down and make them more likely to sit at their desk and not cause trouble. But what does that say about our society if we're using medications for that purpose and that purpose alone? But once the attention is called to the kid, then literally everything starts going click, 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 click. And it takes a very strong parent to stand up and say, no, you're not going to do that to my child. I've read things, and I know that there are other things that we can try. I know that family therapy is effective. I know that parenting skills training is effective. I know that exercise is effective. I know that different study techniques are effective. And I want to try all those things before you start to put my child on medication.
Well, and speaking of medication, in the book you talk about the different ages and stages of ADHD and what parents can do. You also look at the various medications and their side effects. And as you stated, you don't like to medicate. And one of the reasons is that there's a growing concern about the long-term use of these medications.
Well, yeah, the simple answer is we really don't know a lot about the long-term use of these medications in definitive scientific studies or psychiatric studies, but there's a lot of speculation now, and there's some studies that are ongoing, and there's some early returns that are coming in. I mean, first of all, we know that the stimulants are tremendously abused on college campuses, and the reason why is, of course, the studies show emphatically that normals as well as ADHDers, when placed on stimulant medication and given a test, perform better on the test. Now, granted, the ADHD child will have a bigger jump in performance than the quote-unquote normal child, but they both improve. So, of course, if you're in college and you're studying a little bit here and there, but you also have an active social life, then these can be a tremendous crutch for you to be able to study. And then, of course, then that parlays into where you start off using them to study and make a better grade, and the next thing you know, you're taking them to be able to party late into the night because you can drink more without feeling as intoxicated, and so then they become recreational drugs of abuse as well. And then the whole thing is that I ponder here is that, you know, ADHD is, in terms of brain chemistry, is a set of characteristics that center on the dopamine system, which the dopamine is the pleasure reward chemical that's in our brain. And so there have been genetic studies that showed there are different genetics with respect to the dopamine transporter gene, the dopamine receptor gene. But to sum it up, it appears that the ADHDers with their brain have a low dopamine tone. And so, of course, if you have a low tone, then you're not going to be able to focus as well. You're not going to be as excited about things that you're doing unless something really strikes your fancy. So that's why when an ADHDer finds something that they love, the brain activates, the dopamine kicks up, and they're able to hyper-focus for hours on end, and sometimes they get involved with a project that they're just fascinated with and can go for days. The stimulant medications do much the same thing. They raise the dopamine tone in the brain. So you can take a medicine to do it, or you can be aware that there are certain strategies that you can use that will also have the same effect, because if you constantly stimulate the pleasure reward center of the brain with a medication, then the thought is, and my thought is, that eventually you start needing more and more dopamine to get the same response. So you become addicted to the dopamine that you were getting from the pill, and when that's gone, then you're going to crave it.
We started off talking about how the ADHD diagnosis didn't really exist until 1980, and then the diagnosis was redefined before it changed in 1994 to the catch-all ADHD. Can you talk a little more about those revisions? Because it can get a little confusing. ADD is different from ADHD, but now everything's being called ADHD.
Yeah, okay. So just a brief history. You know, there was a precursor to the diagnosis before 1980 in the DSM-2, and that was called the hyperkinetic reaction of childhood. That was essentially hyperactive kids is what that was encompassing. It really didn't talk at all about the attention issues. It didn't talk about the concentration difficulties. So that was the precursor. Then in 1980, the whole thinking was revised to say, you know, this isn't about hyperactivity. This is about a brain that doesn't function optimally. And of course, at that point, it was considered a diagnosis, a disorder, something that needed to be fixed and treated. They had two subcategories, though. They had ADD with hyperactivity or without hyperactivity. But of course, the primary diagnosis then had gone from being hyperactivity to attention deficit disorder with or without hyperactivity. Well, as time went on, those researchers started realizing that, wait a minute, with hyperactivity or without, it's still the same diagnosis. It's still the same set of symptomatology. It's just that some people have the hyperactivity and some people don't. So that led to the eventual change to ADHD, which I personally like the ADD diagnosis better, and then with the subcategories, but it is what it is now, and I think most people recognize ADHD, and so that's what I refer to it as in the book. At the end of the day, I think the compilation of symptoms is based primarily on the attention deficit. Hyperactivity typically goes away anyway when you get older. So, yeah, that's seen with it, but I don't think that defines the condition as much as the difficulties with attention, focus, and concentration.
Many people believe in using diet and nutrition as treatment. How do you feel about diet and nutrition?
Well, there are a host of studies that looked at that, and I think that the bad news for a lot of people that think that nutrition is somehow the answer is that it doesn't look like that's the case. And there are two aspects of that that we would want to look at. Number one is sugar. The popular misperception is that you give kids sugar and that's going to make them hyperactive. And clearly, you cut the sugar out of their diet and these hyperactivity problems are going to go away. Well, there have been multiple studies that looked at that, and it just hasn't borne out. It just hasn't proven to be valid at all. So I think we can safely say at this point that sugar does not cause ADHD. Now, there are certainly individual cases, and I've worked with parents who have kids, where they've noticed that in their particular child that sugar does make them worse. Well, that's fine, okay? But you can't make a blanket statement that ADHD is triggered by sugar. But I always encourage parents, you know what, you want to know your child, you want to work with them closely, and you want to understand, and if you find whenever they have a Coke that they're bouncing out the walls and they're more trouble, well, then yeah, in your particular case, you want to eliminate that. And of course, just good healthy eating, we would want to say, well, we don't want our kids having Coca-Colas anyway, but in terms of it being a causative factor now, there is some other studies that are coming out now that are looking at, actually, there was one that looked at a micronutrient cocktail, so it was multiple vitamins, minerals, and all that they were giving over a period of time and then monitoring symptoms, and they found that it helped. The downside was that it was over 16 pills a day that you had to take of these micronutrients, and a lot of people had stomach problems and all kinds of issues with that. So it helped a little bit. So there is some promising angles on the vitamin, mineral arm of things, and we could figure out exactly what was helping there. That may hold some promise down the road. And then there was another interesting study that looked at preservatives in food and found that there was a slight correlation there. Again, small study, needs to be replicated, needs a lot more science going into that.
This is Dr. Dale Archer. He's the author of this book, The ADHD Advantage. It seems like it must be so difficult for ADHDers in school when we think about things like the Common Core. What should we know about teaching kids with ADHD?
Well, we know what we're doing is not working. That's one thing that we know emphatically. Look, here's a brain that functions differently, and rather than saying, okay, let's look at what we can do in order to optimize this individual's brain, because these people do have the ability to become very successful later in life. They make great entrepreneurs, for example. In professional baseball, it's fascinating, but they have a double the ADHD diagnostic rate in baseball as the general population for adults. So there are things that we're saying, all right, we can point definitively and say that you're going to do better in certain areas in life, but being in the classroom is not one of them. So unfortunately, if you can't afford to get a private education and go to a specialized school where they recognize that, then I think the push for all of us has to be an education of the school system and of the teaching methods that we currently use, and acknowledge the fact that this is not a learning disability, it's a learning difference. And let's approach it that way, and I think these kids could do markedly, markedly better without medication.
Are there other consequences at school for a kid who has this diagnosis?
Well, I think it hurts them psychologically, because all of a sudden, you know, you've got a deficit and you've got a disorder. You've got those two double D's in the diagnosis that just sound so negative. And there's no doubt that some of the psychotherapy techniques that are used with these kids focus on self-esteem. Because once you're slapped with a diagnosis, all of a sudden you're sick. You've got an illness. There's something wrong with me. I'm not as good as everybody else. I'm not like a normal kid. So that has shown amazing promise, is just working with the parents and the student on your brain functions differently, you're not sick, and we're going to teach you why. That shows tremendous promise and probably is the first line of treatment that I would recommend, other than things that you can do on your own, is to get involved in a therapy that focuses on parenting and also the self-esteem of the child.
The book is broken into three sections. The first, called Exploding the Myth, which deals with the diagnosis. The second, Discovering Your Strengths. And the last part, Finding Success. And you mentioned a few minutes ago that ADHDers make great entrepreneurs. There's a high number of baseball players with it. And you do talk in the book about some of the other professions where ADHD can actually be an advantage.
Well, I think that it's important to realize that there is no one area where an ADHDer can't go. So it's not like you can't be a lawyer, you can't be a doctor, you can't be. But there are some things that probably you're not going to do as well at. So you're probably not going to make a great accountant with it if you're working on spreadsheets all day long. On the other hand, as an attorney, you probably wouldn't be a good tax attorney, but you could make a great trial attorney. As a doctor, probably in a routine field, say internal medicine, you may not do as well. But an emergency room doctor, you would do great, because there's that chaos that's going on and you can hyper-focus on that. Entrepreneurship, in fact, I'm working on a piece now for Forbes on the entrepreneur ADHD, and I wrote an early article calling it ADHD, the Entrepreneur Superpower, because we're finding now that these entrepreneurs that are starting their own businesses and multitasking, having to wear multiple hats, never have time to get bored, doing something they love, able to hyper-focus on it, seem to do really, really well. And there's an anecdotal reports that are out there that ADHDers are three times more likely to start their own business than not. So clearly there are success stories in all kinds of fields, and I was very, very careful to pick multiple ones to do it, from being an artist to being a doctor to being a lawyer to being a businessman, entertainer, athlete. So there are no boundaries in terms of what you can do, but you want to think about the career and how you would structure it around your traits and not box yourself into a cubicle doing routine 9-to-5 work over the course of a day of something you really don't enjoy very much.
It's a fascinating, very optimistic book. You offer a lot of strategies that we didn't get a chance to explore. Thank you for your work.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Dale Archer, he's a psychiatrist in Louisiana. The title of the book is The ADHD Advantage: What You Thought Was a Diagnosis May Be Your Greatest Strength. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith Middleton. Thanks for joining us.